This week on the Out of Chicago podcast, we have the man that has tested every camera known to man. It's Goran Lang of CameraLabs.com. If you've ever researched cameras online, I'm sure you've run across CameraLabs.com. Goran Lang is the guy behind all of it at Camera Labs. He's tested all the modern day cameras. They send them to him. They send them on location whenever they're releasing a new one. I know he just got back from testing the Sony A9. I think he did it even before I talked to him on this thing, but he wasn't allowed to talk about it. So we don't talk about the A9 in there, but he does have a review now on his site. So I'll put a link in the show notes and you go check out his review of the Sony A9. But he's tested all the cameras from Fuji, Olympus, Panasonic, Canon, Nikon, all these. And he's going to give us a rundown today in the podcast of kind of, you know, there's not like a best camera better than all the rest of them, but there is a best camera for you. And you're just going to pick one camera or maybe one in a backup, and that's it. So he's going to run through maybe why you'd look at going mirrorless, why you wouldn't, and the difference between all the different manufacturers. Now, if you're interested in these cameras, you can test most of them out at the Out of Chicago conference. It's coming up at the end of June. It's June 23rd through the 25th. We have Art Wolf speaking Friday night, the 23rd, and we'll have our famous photo crawl after that, where you'll go out into the city and you'll shoot the different locations with our instructors. And then on Saturday and Sunday, we have classes and photo walks all day. And we also have an expo and shootout. The shootout is where you get to come and try all the different equipment and go to different rooms, and there will be models. There will be macro setups. Ann Belmont will have her flowers. Bill Fortney will have all this macro stuff set up, and a whole bunch of other people are going to have models there to shoot. And you're going to get to test out all the different lenses from Sigma, from Tamron. You'll get to try out all the different lens babies. You'll get to try stuff from Fuji and from Olympus and from Panasonic. So all that stuff is there for the shootout. It's also available throughout the weekend. You can go at any time, borrow this stuff, take it out into the city and shoot and see what you think about it. So actually, big announcement this week is that we just released single day tickets. So if it's a big commitment to come down and spend the entire weekend, well, you can just come for Saturday or just for Sunday. And if you do that, you're also welcome to come join us on Friday for the photo crawl and with Art Wolf. So single day tickets are only $125, and you get all day Saturday or all day Sunday. And you also get Friday included with that. So go to outofchicago.com to get all that information. And now we're going to get into the interview with Goran Lang, and he's going to talk all about the different cameras, all the different manufacturers, and really just like the state of camera technology right now in 2017. So here we go. Welcome to the Out of Chicago show. I'm here with my good friend and Camera Labs buddy, Goran Lang. Goran, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Chris. It's great to see you again. It's a couple of years since I saw you in person.
I know. It's been crazy. Yeah, you said it was before we even started our conferences. So it was at least three and a half years ago that you came to Chicago, and we spent the whole day shooting. That was awesome. Thanks for doing that.
That was such a good day. I had such a good time. People always say to me, oh, you know, what do you do? Yeah, because I do a lot of traveling. They say, well, can you give us any travel photography tips? And one of the greatest tips I can say is to look up local photographers, because for starters, you're going to meet some great people. You're going to have an immediate friend because you've got stuff in common. But best of all, they'll know where all the best spots are, as Chris indeed did. So he showed me the best of Chicago, and I plagiarized him enormously, stole all of his best shots, and then stuffed him into a book that I'll shamelessly promote later.
No, yeah, you got some shots in there that I want to steal from you from Chicago. So
You're absolutely. Welcome.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that book in a minute. But tell everyone what your big thing is. It's CameraLabs.com. This is how I got to know you. I knew you. It was one of those times, this happens to me all the time with photographers. They're like, I don't know if you've ever heard of me. And I'm like, what do you mean? I'm a huge fan, you know? So I've always been a huge fan of Camera Labs. Tell us the whole thing is and everything you've been doing with it.
Okay, well, I've been a journalist since the early 90s. It's the only job I've really known. I started off in magazines, in print, and some newspaper, did a bit of broadcast. But the whole time, the thing that really drew me into technical journalism was trying to find out how stuff works. And I love photography and imaging. So that was the type of journalism that I was doing. I was finding out how cameras, scanners, printers, Photoshop was brand new, literally, when I started in this industry. So, you know, this was a revolutionary piece of software, you know, and computers going from 8-bit to 24-bit, being able to display full color, that was all happening around that time. So it's very exciting for me. But the thing that frustrated me was not being able to get into the degree of detail that I really wanted to do. I really wanted to understand how this stuff works, and I really wanted to try and explain it to people. And then when I sound so old, when the internet started,
old man.
Communicate a long time ago, but the World Wide Web, when websites kind of first started, I mean, I remember we were some of the first people to have email at my university. And then I ran an email server that went through CompuServe for my work. We had a leased line in the days when you know, that you would actually have a company would plumb a line and it would be very expensive into your office. I worked for this big publishing company. We're the only people with access to the internet. And we started to see the kind of first editorial websites arrive. And of course, they looked horrible, you know, version 1.0 of the internet, which is what I've been doing until recently. And I was looking at them and thinking, wow, you know, these are not classically trained journalists, but they are really giving us a run for our money on the magazines. They're producing fantastic detailed content. The only reason it was on the internet, I mean, the internet wasn't an ideal place to consume that degree of content, but the thing that made it special was that you could just publish on there very, very easily. You didn't have to have an enormous budget behind you. You didn't need the permission of a publisher to do it. You could just do it. And I found that very, very exciting. So the freedom to publish what you want, when you want, immediately, when you've been working on a magazine with a 3-month, you know, lead time, we'd be doing the Christmas issue in summer, you know, trying to feel Christmassy. It was, you know, it's ridiculous. So to have that freedom, the immediacy and the flexibility to write basically whatever you want in whatever degree of detail really appealed to me. So about how long ago now? More than 10 years. Well, actually, I think it says on my t-shirt, established Camera Lab since 2005. So 12 years ago, I launched Camera Labs. And I was still working for the magazines at the time. You know, it's a sort of classic story of the internet. I promoted it organically, you know, so that meant if people found it, great. If they didn't, it didn't. So it took off very, very slowly. It took about a year and a half to be completely commercial. But after a year and a half, it did. It was earning enough and had enough visitors to become a full-time job. So for more than 10 years now, it has been my full-time job. And it is a place where I can be very self-indulgent and do these ridiculously long reviews, which are hopefully still attractive, but I can write up to about 20,000 words on a camera and do these really detailed reviews that take me 2 to 3 weeks to complete. So that's where you'll find all my stuff. So that's my main work.
Yeah. And I remember when I first met you, I was like, what is it that really sets it apart? Because I've always loved Camera Labs, like I said, but what is it that sets it apart? And it was when we met that I realized it's that you have this journalism background, that's where it comes from. Whereas so many reviews that you see out there, people are like, ah, I got a camera and I kind of like this. And here's pictures of the bricks on my house. And yours was so much different than that. And so that's what it is that sets it apart. And that's why.
Yeah. I mean, you know, prior to Camera Labs, if you think about it, so if I launched that in 2005, I was writing professionally for magazines in 1992. So, you know, more than a decade of writing, trying to write unbiased content and dealing with all the manufacturers. So it wasn't like, oh, I bought this nice camera and I thought, you know what I'm going to do? I'll review it. And there's nothing wrong in that. That's great. And it's great that we should, you know, challenge journalists and professionals in every capacity and say, hey, look, you know, I can do this better than you. And that's good. It pushes everyone to try and be better. But equally, what I can offer is the fact that I'd been writing about all of these different companies for over a decade. And that obviously helped me a lot when I was launching the site, because I wasn't just approaching companies like Canon, Nikon, Panasonic and Sony as a newcomer. You know, a lot of people try and do that. It's very difficult to start from scratch, but they were saying, oh yeah, Gordon, you know, we know you from the magazines. And so they were happy to work with me. So that was definitely something that really helped the site take off. But it's great fun being able to do that. I love it.
So what we're going to talk about today in a little bit is I want to get from your perspective, like you're the man. I want to hear, like, what is the state of all the cameras that are out there, whether it's Canon, Nikon, whether it's all the mirrorless stuff that we're seeing now. We're going to get into all of that. But before we do, I want to talk about what we see behind you back there.
or right here. That is your new book. And
you have one too, Chris.
Thank you, Gordon. But what I love about it, besides that you mentioned me in here, but what I love about it is that we see the technical side of you through Camera Labs. And yet when I was shooting with you, I'm like, man, this guy's a great photographer, but it's but this is where you really show off your photography in here. And you really give a lot of great tips as well. Just everything you're doing, whether it's in Chicago and you're shooting through glass and you give tips on that, or reflections and puddles and all sorts of stuff. So I love, I just love how many great photos and all the tips you got. Uh-oh, typo. He found the first typo.
No, I haven't. I'm going to try and find one of the pictures that I took with you by my side. Here it is.
All right. Page 74. Bookmarked, or that's the one. That's the one I'm going to steal from you. Yeah, we went out to North Avenue Beach, and yeah, the water was really low right there. And tell us, yeah, what was the idea here?
Well, the idea behind the whole book really is that all of these images, they're quite unique, because all of these images are JPEGs right out of camera. And I feel that for the past few years, especially with the kind of birth of digital photography, that a lot of the bias or concentration has been on post-processing. It's been on, hey, it's great, you've got this camera, generates this digital file, which means it's very easy to get into a computer or a phone or a tablet and start manipulating it. And, you know, the computers that we have at our disposal are so powerful now, it's amazing what you can do. So the kind of hobby of photography, I'd kind of noticed over the years, it had gone from, you know, classical composition and lighting and timing to one more of post-processing. And that's fine. You know, that's great. If you like that, if it works for you, stay with it. You know, all strength to you. You don't, you know, I don't say to people, this is how you should do things. But what I do like to say is that there are alternatives. So what I was noticing was people saying, oh, I was out shooting with lots of people, and they'd say, I'd glance over at their screens or whatever. I'd say, yeah, I hope you don't think it's rude, but you squint, your picture squint, that horizon's not straight. And they'd say, oh, I can correct that. I'll correct that later. I go, all right. And then I'd say, I noticed that, you know, you are trying to get those converging lines to not converge as much, but they still are a bit. And they'd go, oh, I can fix that later. And the whole time I was thinking, why didn't you fix it now? And they'd say, oh, yeah, I'm shooting. I'd say, well, why are you shooting in RAW? And they say, oh, because I want to be able to retrieve the highlights. And I think, well, sure, there are some extreme situations where you do need to retrieve detail in the highlights and shadows, and things can go wrong. And, you know, you might have a different idea about an approach you want to take. But equally, you can also get the exposure right when you're taking the picture.
Amazing.
You know, if you don't blow your highlights, then you don't need to retrieve them. And there's no shame in having dark shadows or bright highlights. There's no shame in having saturated areas on your image. People think, oh, it's terrible. That's just this big black area, big white area. That's what life is like. Who cares? It looks fine. It looks fine to me. I'm not into a heavily processed style. So I was hearing all of this all the time, and how people were needing to work their images, and that you weren't a proper photographer unless you shot RAW and shot manual. And I thought, I don't really like this. I don't really like this. Sounding a bit like any kind of, like a lot of technical hobbies can sound a bit of snobbery. And while this was going on, I was really getting into mirrorless cameras, which of course shoot 100% in live view. Now, the thing is, if you're shooting with an optical viewfinder and you've got your camera in black and white mode, you can't see in black and white through the viewfinder. You have to imagine what it's like. But with electronic composition, either on a mirrorless camera or in live view on a DSLR, you can preview everything. So you can see your black and white effect. You can see the effect of different white balances. You can overlay alignment grids to check your horizon. You can fire up live histograms and check your tonal range to make sure you're not saturating at either end. The amount of aids at your disposal now are enormous. They're vast. There is literally no excuse to get it wrong. And while that was going on, I was also noticing that JPEG engines were getting better and better with every generation. You know, I've been testing, I test all these cameras for over the years. And, you know, 10 years ago, JPEGs looked pretty ropey. You would be mad to shoot JPEG. You would shoot RAW. Why would you shoot JPEG? But over the past few years, in particular with Fujifilm and Olympus, they've put so much work into their JPEG engines that, to be frank, for me, for my style of photography, I'm getting what I want out of camera. So I thought, you know what? There's a book in this. The book kind of approaches it in three different ways. One is that JPEGs for some things are good enough. Secondly, is that with modern cameras in live view, with mirrorless, you can preview and correct everything in the field. And third, why don't we get back to some good old fashioned techniques and, you know, remind ourselves about composition, lighting, and timing. So that's the thing. This book has got 100 of my travel photos. They're all JPEGs. They're all out of camera, no post-processing. They're all coincidentally from mirrorless cameras, although the techniques equally apply to any camera. And that's what I kind of found quite exciting, that I think when you look through the book, you would go, well, yeah, that's obviously, you know, he's not worked that, that's obvious. But you look at some others and go, oh, that looks quite nice. I didn't think you could achieve that without doing a bit of work on it afterwards. So I wanted to try and prove a point, but also make hopefully an attractive looking travel coffee table book. You know, you could look through it as a professional, as a high-end photographer, and go, well, I don't care about the technique, but that looks nice. I fancy going to that place. Well, that Chris Smith guy looks pretty cool.
He's really cool. No, there are some, you know, there's one where there's like a, some sort of parade and there's like a fish going, yeah. like I'm like, I want to go there. Yeah. That's so
cool. And I mean, to go back to that picture that we showed of Chicago when I was shooting with you, that was the thing is that I also find in photography that that holds some people back gear wise is that they'll have learned a lot of techniques on one camera. And then after a few years or maybe a decade or longer, they will get another camera and they'll apply exactly the same techniques to it. Now, the rules of depth of field and perspective and lighting and shutter speed, they all still apply. You know, this is good stuff to learn that you can apply to any camera. But formats change and features become new and change as well. And if you're shooting a really new camera in exactly the same way as you shot a film SLR 20, 30 years ago, you're not going to be making the most of it. But secondly, you might actually be hampering it. For example, if you're shooting APS-C or Micro Four Thirds, these are smaller formats than full frame or 35 millimeter. You've got to be aware of diffraction. Don't you know, when people talk about a Sunny 16 rule, I cringe. I think do not close these cameras to F-16 because you're going to get diffraction. Everything's going to look horrible. It's fine for full frame or 35 mil, not fine for the smaller formats. And equally, when people tell you, you can't handhold that shutter speed is too slow, you are going to have camera shake. Well, modern cameras, especially from Olympus, have got unbelievable stabilization. And it was an Olympus, I think, an EM5 Mark I was shooting when I met you. And the stabilization has got better even since then. But that was good enough for me to handhold that shot. Not only was that handheld, so I didn't have a tripod to slow me down to set up, but I wanted to get the camera actually in the water. And that would normally involve getting your feet wet, right? But because I was shooting in live view with a screen that articulated, I could angle the screen out, hold the camera arm's length so it was over the water, and use the stabilization to prevent my coffee hands from wobbling, and snap the picture off. And it's adopting those new technologies like an articulated screen, live view, and built-in stabilization that allowed me to take that picture. So it's a book about embracing new tech, but also remembering some old tech. That we, right. You know, all techniques that we used to use.
Right. The biggest example I can think of how you're talking about people not adapting to the new stuff is I see so many people that are still like talk about getting like a little right angle viewfinder, you know what I'm saying? Like, so they can still look through the viewfinder, and it's like, no. It's all in live view. You know, you're on a tripod, just you live view. Or if it's mirrorless through the, yeah, I mean,
because well, you see people with DSLRs shooting video, and because of the way a DSLR works, you can't shoot video through the viewfinder, right? The mirror is flipped up, at which point it might as well be a mirrorless camera. But what it does mean is that you have to compose with the screen. And if it's a bright, sunny day, you're going to see it. So they have loops on the back of the camera. So they actually have a device to circumvent the fact that it's a DSLR. And the whole time I'm thinking, if you were doing this with a mirrorless camera, you could be composing this and playing it back through an electronic viewfinder. That's going to give a far better experience than you're seeing with that loop. And, you know, I think you're loopy to do it. You know, I mean, people, that's the classic, you know, definition of someone who has learned it one way and they're staying with it. But again, you know, we can talk about this and we are talking about this, but at the end of the day, I'm not going to say you've got to do this or you're a fool if you don't do it this way or if you do it that way. Do whatever works for you. Well, the thing I'm most interested in is the work itself. I want to see your pictures. I want to see your videos. And if you're happy with them, great. If someone else is happy with them, even greater. You know, you're doing it. It's a hobby either for you or, you know, when we're posting socially, we want those likes and stuff. I don't care how you went about doing it necessarily or whether you did it my way or the highway, you know, but there are other ways. There are other ways out there. And it's important to learn about how a new camera works to get the most from it. You've got to stay open-minded. It makes my job exciting and interesting because we're constantly relearning, aren't we?
Yeah. Every time I get a new camera, and I do that quite often, it's a matter of sitting on the couch or laying in bed and going through every menu. And that's always fun for me. I'm like, ooh, this looks good. And
yeah.
So you must do a lot of that, I'm sure.
Definitely. And I mean, the features that are on them now, I mean, this is why the reviews are so long. I'll get through the just, yes, it takes pictures and it films video. And it's like this raft of other features that you go through and you think, you look at them and you think, you know, I've got to draw a line somewhere. I'm not gonna mention that. And then you think, and then I go to sleep and I wake up and I'm thinking, I really want to know how it works. I got to know how it works. And then I spend the next 3 days just finding out about a new feature that's been introduced on something, you know, like say in camera focus stacking, you know, how is it doing it and does it do a good job of it? That sort of stuff.
Right.
It's great. It keeps you busy.
So here's what I want from you, Gordon. This is the big question. I want you to be able to put together for us, you know, if you are this type of a shooter, you should probably consider maybe this brand or these cameras. If you are, you see what I'm saying? Because I want to say that all of these cameras that we're talking about today, they're all going to take amazing photos if you use them correctly, right? I mean, none definitely. Of you go, oh, stay away from that. It's going to be terrible.
that doesn't happen anymore in business.
No, but some of them, depending on what you're doing, are better for certain things. Here, where am I? Hold on.
Yeah, you could. You need a book stand for that, Chris. It's so far away.
Oh no, I'm blocking it a little. All right,
it's
I'll
so
just sit
far
over
away.
Here. I'm good. Sorry about that.
That's great. I love that it's visible. It's visible regardless of who's been watching.
That's
my camera book in bookstores now in Amazon across the regions. Amazon.com, co.uk, Kindle versions. It's all there.
It just came out, right?
In the US, it just came out. It's been out in the UK for a couple of weeks, but the US and kind of rest of the world, they held it back for about 2 weeks. But it's now available everywhere. And also, if you buy it, you're supporting my reviews at Camera Labs because, you know, these websites like mine, they are pretty much one-man operations. And we completely rely on donations or people buying through affiliate links or buying merchandise like the t-shirts and stuff. And the nice thing about buying the book is that you get a book and you get to support my work. So if I've ever done anything useful for you at all, then this is one way you can help. But you know, just watching and enjoying it is a great way as well.
My favorite is you've always had the little photo of you, you know, buy me a coffee, you know, just help out a little bit. And the best part was when you came to Chicago, we were right at the Intelligentsia, right at the coffee shop.
Exactly.
I said, Gordon, you can do it for real. Let me get you a coffee. So,
and it was mighty fine coffee, as I recall. They're from Chicago, aren't they, Intelligentsia?
Yeah,
I've had theirs in New York since. I think they're all over the country now, aren't they?
Really? I don't know. I know they're still here.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Well, we'll definitely get another one of those. I didn't have the bean, the kidney bean.
Oh, the coffee bean. No, the bean.
The big, you know, the big reflective.
I'm just kidding. I know. Yeah. Did you get good ones of that? I don't remember if we shot. I don't think we shot that when we were there.
No. I did it without you. And that's why it went wrong.
That must be it.
That's right. It for sure. But I wasn't with you at the top of the, where did I go? At the top of the John Hancock, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's
you can't go wrong there. You just got to, I mean, as I explained in the book, you know, when you're shooting through glass, minimize your reflections, press that lens right up against the glass, use a lens hood, or I use my beanie hat to shade stuff. I've also got a picture from the top of the New World Trade Center in New York, same technique. Explore your different picture styles as well. Black and white works really well because sometimes that glass is dirty. Move it around and you'll see blobs move around. You'll be like, yep. There's a big mark on that glass. I won't use that bit. Black and white is very forgiving through a window and you can bump up the contrast. You don't have to do it in post. You can do it inside the camera.
Interesting.
You can do all that stuff. Because I do shoot RAW plus JPEG. You know, I do shoot RAW as kind of insurance and you can process RAW files in playback in most cameras now. So it gives you a chance to explore the options, you know, try different simulations or styles, boost the contrast, turn down the noise reduction, all that sort of stuff. Again, without going near Photoshop. I love Photoshop, but this book is all about, and my whole philosophy of photography is to try and do it in camera. But we were not talking about that. Do you see how I turned that around, Chris?
No, that's good. That's great. Yeah.
He is in the business, you see. He is. I can just turn it back around to me.
That's perfect. No, I'm the king of that. So yeah, we won't even go into that.
Let's talk about the companies.
Let's do it. Is that the way to go about it, or should?
We can do it any way you want.
So let's start with Canon, Nikon.
I'm glad you said them together because I was thinking about this because we spoke earlier about maybe some things we could discuss, and you mentioned you wanted to do something about this. And I thought, well, what would I say about Canon and Nikon? And everything that I thought about them applied to both of them, really, mostly. Mm-hmm. And that is that obviously they're both very traditional companies. They've been around for a very long time. They've got a lot of experience. And you will see this as we discuss the different brands. The ones with the most experience in making cameras, including Olympus is another one, it really shows in the design and the ergonomics and the controls of the bodies that they're putting out. And this is of critical importance, I think, as a photographer, because a camera is an extremely physical item. It's got so many buttons and it fits in your hand. I mean, it's like a glove. It's got to fit your hand perfectly where your fingers fall. The feel of the buttons, I'm turning a little wheel here, in an imaginary wheel with my index finger. Is it on the front?
That was an Olympus.
Yeah. Is it on the front? Is it angled? Is it on the top? Am I using my thumb? Is it at the top? Is it at the back? How am I turning it? When I turn it, does it click audibly? Do I feel those increments? How do I know? Because when you're changing, say, the aperture, and you think, I want to change it one stop, I want to double or half the brightness, the amount of light that's coming in. Most lenses, most exposure systems work in 1/3 increments, right? So you need to turn it. You need 3 clicks in order to make a stop. Right. So when I turn that wheel, I want to definitely know it's turned 3 times. I do not want it to slip a 4th time accidentally. And I don't want to go, have I done it twice or 3 times? And, if it's a bit mushy. This is a very personal thing. And a camera that I think does it really well might be one that you think sucks at it. And this is why, before saying anything else, I can tell you straight away which one's got the best autofocus, which one does the best JPEGs out of camera, which one's got the best Wi-Fi apps, blah, blah, blah. But ultimately, if you pick it up in the shop and you're like, oh, crumbs, I hate this camera, it's going to stay on the shelf and you're not going to shoot with it. And you're going to shoot with whatever you had before, the thing that you were supposed to replace, right? Probably your phone. And that sucks. That's not right. You bought something that you think should be right and it wasn't right. And even the look of the thing, right? Mm-hmm. If it doesn't look right to you, it's got to look attractive. And it says a lot about you as well. It's like choosing a coat or a hat or something. It's a very important personal thing. And that brings me back to Canon, Nikon and Olympus with all of their experience in photography and designing bodies. They've been doing it for a very long time. And it really shows. Now, they're packing in a lot of modern technology inside, but on the outside, you get decades, decades of experience. And as such, in terms of controls and ergonomics, I think those 3 companies are the best out of all of them. Canon, Nikon, and Olympus. I love their controls on big cameras or small cameras. They do it right. They feel right. They look right. They work right. And they've, even the user interfaces, I mean, they vary a lot, but they put a lot of thought into it. And that really shows. So I find it hard to beat them in terms of ergonomics.
I totally agree. Like I shot Canon forever and just to have the dials right where I expect them. But then Olympus was even better, that it's got the front and the rear dial and you can program them however you want. I love that. It's my favorite part about the Olympus cameras.
Yeah, definitely. I love that. And I don't think the sort of standard of ergonomics, you cannot underestimate how important that is. It's of absolute critical importance. But also the system itself is critically important. Are the lenses, accessories available that you want? And are they priced the way you want them to be? Are they available secondhand? If you can't afford to buy these things new, then you need access to a good secondhand market. You've got to think about all these things when you're going into a system. And this is another benefit of Canon and Nikon in particular that they share. They both have enormous catalogs of lenses and accessories. And because they're the 2 most popular brands, Canon in particular, there's a lot of it out there. Loads of it out there. You will easily, let's say you think tomorrow I want to buy an 85mm f1.8 lens, you will find plenty of them secondhand.
Yeah, if I went on Craigslist right now, I'd find one. But if I went for a Fuji, 5612, whatever, exactly. It's most likely not going to be there.
Mm-hmm. Exactly right. So you've got that flexibility, you've got that just the broadness of those catalogs and the availability. And that's really hard to beat. Although, as I discovered when I was kind of finding out how many lenses are in each system, I mean, Olympus has a lot now and Sony has more than you think. Fuji still doesn't have that many, but we'll talk about them separately. So in terms of the system, Canon, Nikon, again, very, very good for that. if we started to look at the actual cameras themselves, both of those companies also have a vast range of bodies available, from entry level to a degree of professionalness, if that's a word, that doesn't exist on any of the other companies. So where most companies, like say Sony's most expensive camera would be what, the A7R Mark II, which would be about $3,000. Well, that's peanuts compared to Canon and Nikon. You know, you can spend $5,000 on one of their cameras. You can, you know, you can go to like a D5 or a 1DX Mark II and start spending, you know, some ridiculous money. And these are tough cameras. You know, these are designed to be dropped on concrete, to be used if someone's coming at you in a war zone. Not only will it deflect bullets, you could hit someone over the head with it. Right. Use it as an offensive weapon, you know. And you know, I when you look at the highest end of, say, the mirrorless cameras, they're getting pretty tough and they're weatherproof and all the rest of it, but it's not in the same league as something like a 1DX Mark II or a D5. These are something else. And as such, there are some people who need that. And there are some people who want that. They don't need it. They just want it. They like the idea of it. And that's partly what these two companies appeal to, you know? So you'll see a lot of professional sports or reportage or war photographers using these two brands for their reliability. Also, again, looking at the system, if you're a professional and your camera breaks, who's going to fix it? Well, especially if you're, you know, if you're in the middle of Chicago or New York or London, then yeah, you'll probably get it fixed quite easily. What if you're in the middle of the desert? What if you're in the middle of the Arctic? Is someone going to chop her in a replacement? I don't know if Canon's professional services would chop her in a replacement, but certainly they have networks available to support you. Now, Chris, you probably had enough pro gear to be CPS, weren't you? Have you had any experience of Canon professional services?
Yeah, they've always been great. Should I say this? I don't have Canon right now. I got all Fuji stuff actually. Mm. But yeah, I did. I was always in CPS and they were great every time I had to deal with them, for sure.
What was the best thing they did for you? What was the most difficult thing you gave them that they resolved and you thought, man, this is why?
Well, I'll tell you the thing they didn't resolve, which was when I dropped my 17 millimeter tilt shift lens. Yeah, it's over here somewhere. The insurance paid for it, but yeah, that was a sad one. Well, I mean, the best thing that they would do is you could send something to them, and once they got it, you'd get it back like the next day or 2 days later. It was immediately back to you. And I don't think Fuji has a program. I think they're talking about putting one out maybe just for the new medium format.
Yes, yeah, they are. They're starting that, yeah.
But yeah, like for the X-T2, I don't think they have a program for that, for those cameras.
I'm not sure. I think you'd need to check, and it depends per region. But it's something that I know that all of the companies are very aware of now. So if a company doesn't have it, I would expect them to have it quite soon. I think it's something that they're all realizing, if they want to be taken seriously as professional products, then they need a professional backup and a network to produce that, to support that. But then, you know, when all you've got to do is wait for a huge global event to take place, an entertainment event or a sporting event like the Olympics, the World Cup, the Super Bowl, any of these things, have a look at what the photographers are shooting and you'll see a raft of white lenses, which are the Canon ones, and a raft of black ones, which are the Nikon ones. And you'll see one or two crazy people, and they're not crazy people, I think they're great, who are shooting it and proving you can do with mirrorless and other formats. But the fact is the majority of them are still shot on Canon Nikon. So there's that. And that's a certain cachet, again, with certain people, you know, they want that. Also, when we look at the other formats that I'll talk about in a moment, they've done very well at getting off the ground with a lot of lenses. But you'll get to a point where if you're into something really exotic like a super telephoto lens, then you'll find that there's a lot of 100 to 400s out there, you know, but not much longer than 400 millimeter on any of the mirrorless formats. But, you know, Canon, Nikon, 500, 600s, 800s, in Canon's case, 1200. Nikon will probably furnish up their 2000 mil catadioptric telescope for you if you want it. You know, there's a lot of stuff. So if you're shooting sports or bears or eagles or something like that, then
it probably is a better choice, don't you think?
Yeah, I think so.
That was your main thing. I would say Canon, Nikon, I think.
Yeah, and in terms of like their autofocus, it's very, very good. And I mean, I love especially what Sony's doing with autofocus, but in terms of like sports and stuff, Canon and Nikon are still very, very good at it. Nikon in particular are very good at tracking autofocus. A few of the differences you'll notice, Canon has kind of taken the lead over Nikon in terms of video quality. So if you were to choose between them and that, their dual pixel CMOS AF technology is very, very strong. And it's now finally being deployed across a broader range of bodies. It has finally made it onto a mirrorless camera. Nikon has had mirrorless for a while, Nikon One system, but because they went with the 1-inch sensor for speed, people kind of thought that was a bit small. Canon have had the technology, but they've just been very slow at getting it out. Finally, we'll be getting something like the EOS M5. It's a nice body, but it's behind what the other mirrorless companies are doing. And Canon, if they want to be taken seriously in this, they need to go forward. So to me, both Canon and Nikon are a bit old-fashioned. They're used to developing at a slower pace, and I think they're being caught out by companies like Sony and Panasonic in particular, who are consumer electronics companies, and they are used to developing at a faster pace, an annual or even a six-monthly cycle for some of their products, when Canon and Nikon are still on three-yearly cycles. Means, you know, I mean, in the period between a 5D Mark III and a 5D Mark IV, Sony had released their entire A7 series from scratch, you know, like six or seven bodies. That's in the same period of time that Canon did one. That's what we're dealing with here. So they've got to really work out what they're doing. And we've already seen Nikon, you know, has made some, you know, some announcements about how their finances and stuff are doing, and that they've had to drop the DL, which is a shame because that looked like a really good camera. Hopefully they'll focus on their core and still produce some really good DSLRs. Hopefully, I'd love to see another mid-range, like a replacement to D7200, because that was a great camera. But again, every time I pick up a Nikon camera, I think, wow, this is really nice. D500 was really nice. The D750 was really nice. They're all really nice. So right. They're both a bit old-fashioned. I think they could do with getting down with the crazy kids, so we're going to move on to next. But, you know, we're not all crazy kids, and some people like tradition.
So I want to be a sports photographer full-time, or wildlife most of the time. There's still a place that Canon, Nikon is going to beat those other ones for the most part, if that's your main thing, possibly.
Yeah, especially for access to the massive lenses. You know, if you want a massive and bright lens, then it's hard to, no one else is really offering that at the moment. Mm-hmm. You can adapt Canon quite successfully to Sony, but I find it best to keep things native.
All right, where do you want to go next?
Well, let's go on to mirrorless. Although obviously they didn't start with mirrorless. Olympus, we'll kind of talk about Panasonic at the same time, because so Olympus, these are two very different companies. Olympus is obviously a camera company with a massive amount of heritage, and they did a variety of digital cameras. But for me, it all kind of came together with Micro Four Thirds, which was a format they co-developed with Panasonic, who, of course, are a huge consumer electronics company who also have a massive amount of experience in video, especially professional video, broadcast video. So it's no real surprise to see how these two companies have kind of diverged into their own specialities. But the interesting thing, though, is that they developed this format together. So they share the same lens mount, and that, coupled with the fact that they were the first mainstream mirrorless format out there, means that they have the biggest catalog of lenses and bodies, because they're both developing for it. And of course, you've got the third parties as well. But you can put an Olympus lens on a Panasonic body, a Panasonic lens on an Olympus body, and that means, you know, and they're competing against each other. I think perhaps a bit too much. I think I would like to see them work more together, because some of them will have some features that only work with their own lenses. And you're like, oh, I wish they'd talk more to each other. So we talked before about how Canon, Nikon, and Olympus have this heritage, and Olympus has put that into their digital cameras. So you've got these cameras that I think really kicked off this whole kind of retro look that Fujifilm is doing really well with now as well. And their cameras look very, very attractive, but they're very, very modern inside. And one of the technologies that Olympus really pushed and is doing extremely well with is built-in stabilization. And they put it in all of their cameras, and they're at least a few generations ahead of everyone else. And although Panasonic is catching up very quickly now, in my tests, Olympus still edges ahead. And the things that you can do with them are ridiculous. So, I mean, you know, I drink a lot of coffee, so I have coffee hands. I shake quite a lot, but I can hand hold a 24 mil equivalent. So that's 12 mil on Micro Four Thirds, a 24 mil equivalent wide angle lens on an Olympus body. I can hand hold a 1 second exposure.
Wow.
And if I'm careful on the latest ones, I can do a 2 second. And if I'm super careful, like if I'm, so I'm now hand holding it, but holding it to my face. So I've got that extra, that third point of contact. I can do 4 seconds. Do 4 seconds handheld. And you look at that and you think, well, wait a minute, that completely changes photography. And I talked about this in my book, that I love, like most photographers, shooting in the blue hour, not the morning blue hour. That's for the crazies. The evening blue hour, you know, the civilized, just before cocktail hour. That's the best time to shoot. But it can get quite dark, especially when it's, you know, just before it gets really dark. And you want those nice, clean, sharp images of your landscapes and of your, you know, city views at night. You don't want to be bumping up the ISO too high. You want to shoot at nice, low ISOs. And you don't want the aperture all the way open. You want your lenses to perform nice and sharp. So inevitably, the thing that's got to give is the shutter speed. And you'll easily find yourself at half a second, 1 second, 2 seconds, which traditionally would mean shooting with a tripod. Well, not with these amazing stabilization systems. I can now handhold almost all of my blue hour shots, which is something I could never do before. And I really put this to the test in the beautiful city of Ghent in Belgium, which I travel to quite a lot because it's quite close to where I live. It's only an hour drive from the Channel Tunnel, which is why I love living where I do. And it's a very popular city to photograph. It's got canals, it's got beautiful Gothic architecture and great reflections. I've got some pictures of some Belgian cities in my book, and they're really, really attractive. And you see people, as the blue hour approaches, setting up their big cameras on a tripod. And you know at certain times of year that the blue hour is not going to last very long, so maybe not even an hour. So they're only going to get like one shot, two shots, two different setups. They're going to set up for one, and then if they're lucky, they might be able to relocate and set up somewhere else. But really, they're looking again. They're hoping to come home with one good picture. Well, if you're shooting handheld, you're so quick on your feet that you can get 10 different pictures. And then one night in Ghent, I was shooting all these. I came back with about 5 different good pictures that I was really happy with. And, you know, that's a ratio I'm very happy with. And at first, the people with their D810s and 5D Mark IIIs at the time, all on their tripods, they were looking at me, they were laughing, they were like, you're not going to get any good pictures, you're hand-holding, they're going to be rubbish. And I am into long exposure photography.
They didn't know who they were dealing with.
Exactly, exactly. And if you do want to really smooth out water, yeah, you need 30 seconds, 60 seconds. So I'm not going to hand-hold a minute, am I? But if I'm only hand-holding a second, yes, you can. And it just allowed me to get so many pictures. So that's the thing. And for me, it made, because a lot of people go, oh, the Mercury 40, but the sensor, it's small. It's smaller than APS-C, and APS-C is smaller than full frame. I don't want Micro Four Thirds. It's too small. And I say, yeah, but where are you going to actually notice the difference? In my tests, you've got to go up to like about 3200 ISO, 6400 ISO to really see any noise benefit between Micro Four Thirds and APS-C. And you've got to go higher to see it with full frame. So shoot at lower ISOs. Because of the fantastic stabilization, I can stay at 200 or 400 ISO. I never shoot higher. I have no need. Hmm. You know, I can shoot those low ISOs where you would not tell the difference between one of my pictures on Micro Four Thirds at 200 ISO compared to full frame. In terms of noise levels, you will not tell the difference. People might say, oh, what about the dynamic range? I want to retrieve those highlights. Get your exposure right. You don't need to retrieve the highlights. Get the exposure
come
right.
Full circle. It all comes together. Yeah.
You know, and so again, you know, using that new technology allows you to then exploit this other system. And the lenses, because the sensor's small, that's a benefit. It means that my lenses are small, my lenses are light. I can carry a lot more of them in a smaller space. You can use a smaller tripod without compromising stability. You know, the accessories, everything becomes smaller and lighter, more portable. And that kind of new way of shooting made me feel that Olympus, to me, is one of the best all-round companies. That's great stabilization, fantastic out-of-camera JPEG quality, beautiful controls, cameras that look really nice. Olympus is one of my favorite brands, and that I really, really like their cameras. So that for me, I think they're one of the best all-rounders.
So for the people that do the type of photography that you do, which is a lot of travel and a lot of shooting in cities, Olympus, you think may be the choice right there?
Yeah, that stabilization is really hard to beat, because what I really like about it is that you can stabilize prime lenses, which aren't stabilized. Right. You know, lots of zooms have got optical stabilization. That's great. Well, zoom schmooms. I'm not interested in zooms. I like shooting with prime lenses, fixed focal length lenses, because they make me work. They make me explore the scene, step back a bit, go forward a bit, crouch down, you know, lean overhead, all of these things. But most prime lenses, not all, but most are unstabilized, which means if, you know, when you're shooting with a telephoto, not even a long telephoto, just a mid-length telly, the view's doing this. You know, you're trying to line something up and it's doing that, you know, through the viewfinder. But with Olympus, you half press that shutter, the stabilization kicks in and it's just rock solid. And you can just say, I just move that left a bit, up a bit, rotate it a bit. That's spot on. Take the picture, move on. And I like trying to get things exactly right. Remember when you're shooting out a camera, none of these pictures in the book are cropped either.
Wow.
So I want to make sure the framing's right. And if I want something to be in the middle, I have to make sure it's in the middle. And I do that with the alignment grids, and the stabilization really helps for that. So I think Olympus is a great all-round. So yeah, great for travel. Now, of course, some people do need to shoot at 6,400, 12,800 ISO and have a clean result because they need to a fast shutter speed in low light. They're shooting sports, gymnastics, events in low light, and they need to freeze the action. Then you need a high ISO. That's where these smaller formats struggle. Of course, they're still taking photos. So at that point, it's a question of what are your expectations? Mm-hmm. You know, is it good enough? If right. you want it to be super duper clean, then sure, but spend a lot of money on a full frame camera with a big lens and lug it around. You can do that.
Well, that's what I was going to say too, is that you can get an equivalent Olympus with, you know, that'll do the frame rate and everything else for a lot less money than you would get for Canon or Nikon.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, models like the EM1 Mark II, which is their latest flagship body, so fast, you know, I mean, they're shooting, off the top of my head, what was it like?
If anyone would know.
15 or 20 frames per second at full resolution in RAW.
Crazy.
You know? And you can't do that with the full frame DSLRs. I mean, they shoot fast, but it's hard work shooting that quickly, and you need that big massive body to, you know, that right, mirror is doing this.
Yeah,
you need something to damp that. That's a massive physical undertaking, and they manage it, but it costs a lot, and it's big and it's heavy. So, you know, they can shoot sports. The mirrorless ones are getting really good at it, and we'll talk about Cerny in a minute, which I've used at the Tour de France with great success. So, you know, you can shoot sports with it. So Olympus is great all-rounder. Moving on to Panet. Now, what they've never been brilliant at is video. They're getting a lot better at it. The EM1 Mark II is their best yet, and it is very, very good. And especially when you combine it with the built-in stabilization, you could imagine shooting without a rig or anything like that. You know, you put on a prime lens, doesn't matter. You're hand-holding it, flip out the screen, shoot at any angle you want. Really, really nice. Panasonic, though, with their heritage in video, professional broadcast video, inevitably are going to be better at it. And they are. They're one step ahead, well, several steps ahead of Olympus in that regard. And models like their latest flagship, the GH5, has raised the bar for everyone. You know, it shoots 4K at 60p when everyone else is doing 30p, where everyone else stops recording after half an hour. They can keep recording while you've got memory and battery remaining, 2 hours with a standard battery, 2 hours uninterrupted, 4K at 60p. It'll record 10-bit internally. You don't need an external recorder. Again, that makes it very portable. It now has very good built-in stabilization too. And things like built-in, you know, I was talking about the benefit of having all of these electronic aids. It's got like vectorscope diagrams now and what else? Waveform displays that you would normally have an external monitor to do when you're filming. You don't need that now. You can, but you don't need it. You know, what you end up with is this camera that does everything you want. And it's, you know, it's relatively small. It's big for a mirrorless camera, but you're not sticking all this stuff on it. You know, you must see filmmakers. They love sticking stuff.
Right.
And then they all complain, my back's ruined. It's like, yeah, have you seen what you're looking around?
I saw a photo yesterday and they were like, oh, shooting with this DSLR. I'm like, no, that's some huge contraption. I look inside the whole thing. There's like a 5D Mark III or something in the middle of all this other stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Or invariably like a Sony A7S Mark II or something like that. You know, this tiny little camera inside this massive rig. You don't necessarily need it. They're trying to produce these systems that have got everything you want built in. So Panasonic are really good at that. They've really taken the idea of 4K and run with it. They now do 4K video. It's not a premium feature for them anymore. It's on almost every single one of their cameras, even entry-level cameras. You can do 4K video. And they've looked at 4K and gone, you know what? 4K is so high resolution, it's capturing 8 megapixels worth of data on every frame. And of course, it's capturing those frames at video frame rates, 30 frames a second. Or higher. And they then made the leap to think, well, why don't we actually frame grab from it and take still photos from video? Why don't we create this kind of video photo hybrid mode? They call it 4K photo. Now 6K photo on the GH5, and it's doing 18 megapixel stills, which is pretty respectable. And you're effectively now shooting at, you know, forget your 5 frames per second, your 8, your 10, your 11, or 15 frames per second. You're now shooting at 30 frames per second or 60 frames per second. Sure, with 4K only at 8 megapixels, but good enough for some things. The ability to shoot at those high frame rates. Panasonic makes it so easy to extract pictures from those really, really nice. You can do things like it can capture a burst. This is one of their cleverest things. You can capture a burst of video where it racks focus from closest to furthest within that. And it remembers, as soon as anything goes into sharp focus, it remembers where it was, right? And it stores this in an extra data file that's stored in this video. It takes about 2 seconds to do it. What that means in playback is that you can tap the screen anywhere on the screen, and the camera knows at what point in that video it needs to fast forward or rewind to in order to find that bit when that bit you've tapped out was in focus. So what you end up with something that looks like a light field camera, where you can literally change the focus after the event. All it's doing is fast forwarding, rewinding through a video file that happens to remember where the top corner was in focus or the middle was in focus. But you've forgotten all that at that point. You've forgotten the fact it took 2 seconds to catch, because you're now in the pub with your mates, tapping the screen saying, look at that. Those apples. That's impressive. Stuff like that. You know, when I was talking about adopting new technology and testing it all, I mean, they even do focus stacking with it now. You know, they don't only say, do you want the closest thing or the furthest thing in focus? How about you want it all in focus between here and here? And you tap the range and it will go away. 2 seconds later, it's generated a focus stacked image. So
really, so like if I've got a rock in the foreground and a mountain in the background, I tap it to tell it that's the front focus that I, yep. And then the mountain and it does it automatically.
It then, because it's got everything focused in between, it just literally frame grabs all of the images that it needs and then stacks them, and it's all done in camera.
Wow.
And it's stuff like that. You look at that and you think, wow, Panasonic are doing some really, really clever stuff. I mentioned earlier about numbers of lenses. Last time I counted Micro Four Thirds lenses, there were over 75 of them. You know, a lot of people think, oh, mirrorless is, you know, it's not got as many as Canon and Nikon. 75 Micro Four Thirds lenses. That's a lot of lenses. Now, there are no super duper telephoto lenses. I think the longest lens in Micro Four Thirds natively with autofocus is a Leica 100 to 400 zoom, which is the darling of wildlife photographers. It's quite a new lens. It's fantastic. It works really well on both Olympus and Panasonic bodies. All bird photographers have this lens now. It's really, really good. And of course, with Micro Four Thirds, the sensor size, 2x field reduction, so 400 becomes 800 mil in terms of magnification, field size. But they still don't have like a, you know, an 800 mil 5.6, or you know what I mean, or 6.4. They don't have anything like that with that kind of depth of field and length as well. But they've got pretty much everything else. I mean, there's even a choice of 3 fisheye lenses. More now. And I mean, one of them, the Olympus one, is f1.8, so it's the brightest fisheye lens as well. You can shoot with that under any conditions. It's amazing. So if you're into video, Panasonic has got to be one of the best around. And again, as an all-rounder, a fantastic brand as well. And for mid-range cameras, I mean, I keep coming back to like their recent, we call it the G80. I think you call it the G85, or it might be the other way around, because they have different names for North America and Europe. But that camera is such good value for money. It does so much. That's fantastic. And if you're a professional videographer, the GH5 is almost impossible to beat. Even if you've got an A7S Mark II, a full-frame Sony, you know, unless you shoot video above 6400 ISO all the time, then the GH5 is a really serious camera.
Yeah, yeah. Our guy here, Brian Essler, who helps with a lot of the stuff here, he just got the GH5. I think it came in yesterday for him. So he said he's loving it, and he was shooting it in the bar. And yeah, so.
And your events, Chris. I mean, when you're doing your events, your shows, how long would a typical kind of lecture or talk be?
It might be an hour, hour and a half for some of them.
Mm-hmm. So with the GH5, you could put that, you could just press record and you don't need to go back to it. Yep. It'll just record for 2 hours until it runs out.
That's the thing people don't realize, a Canon or a Sony, right? A lot of them, they got to
stop at half an hour.
Yeah, mm-hmm, exactly. Yeah.
Or some of them stop sooner because they've overheated.
Right.
You know, you can normally start another clip straight away, but you know, you're having to join them together. You're having to schedule toilet breaks or ad breaks so that you know, when you edit it together afterwards. But if someone's midway through a speech or something interesting happens, you know, wouldn't it be nice to have a camera that just keeps recording? And of course you can do that with professional cameras or camcorders. They are designed to just keep recording. But the kind of interchangeable lens market, you know, if you want one of those cameras, they all stop at half an hour. The GH5 is quite unique in that regard. And it's doing it in 4K and it'll do it at 60p, you know. And it's $2,000. You can do this with a $10,000 camera. This is a $2,000 camera that you could put in a large pocket. So it's, you know, it's a very compelling message that they have. I do feel that their ergonomics are not as good as Olympus or Canon or Nikon. You know, their controls, they need a bit of work on that. They're thinking like an electronics company, not like a camera company. So that needs a bit of work. But in terms of the feature set and the video quality, brilliant. And their JPEGs are getting better and better with each generation. And their stabilization is that close to Olympus now. Very, very close.
So if you want a travel camera, you want something smaller, makes all your lenses, tripod, all everything smaller, the Micro Four Thirds, whether it's Panasonic or Olympus, are both perfect. Olympus, if you're more the traditional, I'm mostly going to shoot stills, it's Olympus. If you are thinking you're going to do video as well, it's Panasonic. Did I boil that down there?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And you may pick up a Panasonic and go, I don't know what he's talking about. I think the ergonomics are fantastic.
Well, yeah, that too, like we said in the beginning. All right.
Let's move on. There's two of my favorites coming up. Who do you want to do first?
Let's do Sony.
Okay, Sony. So Sony's another consumer electronics company. And when they went into cameras, they had to think, right, how are we going to do it? How are we going to be taken seriously in this market? So what they did is they bought a camera company. They bought Minolta, Konica Minolta. And immediately had access to their lens mount, which they rebranded as the Alpha A mount, and access to a bunch of lenses and obviously Konica Minolta's heritage in making cameras. And to that, Sony added their expertise in electronics and marketing and ranges and all of that stuff. And very quickly carved a niche for itself in technology. You know, Sony makes sensors for almost everybody. So they were way ahead of everyone on that. And they became particularly good at auto-focusing and burst speeds. Even now, for the money, it's very hard to find a camera that either focuses better or shoots as fast as a Sony at any price point. You know, if someone shoots at 5 or 6 or 7 frames per second, well, Sony's doing it at 11 or 12 at the same price point. So if you're into sports with a mirrorless body, I would say straight away, Sony's the company you've got to look at, because they now embed phase detect AF points virtually over the entire sensor on their APS-C models anyway, like the A6000. Which is so cheap. The A6300 and the A6500, those cameras are amazing. I've taken all three of those now to the Tour de France. And, you know, whatever you think about cycling or whatever they take or don't take, I really enjoy watching that sport, but we all know they cycle very quickly, right? Especially going down the hill. Well, I've been sat next to professional photographers with Nikon D5s and Canon 1DX Mark IIs with a Sony A6000, right? $500 camera. And they look at you again, they're like, what an idiot. You're putting all this effort to climb up this mountain to get to this really good corner, you know, and this is what you brought. Although I have to say that it's not due to my fitness level that I'm not out of breath at that point. It's because my camera only weighs 0.5 kilogram and theirs weighs about 3 kilos, and they've been lugging it up, and they've got cars from the bigger and heavier lenses too. But, you know, you look at them and you think, well, we've both got the same focal length. We're both pretty much in the same position. Cyclist's going to come around the corner in a minute. Let's see what happens. So the first time you hold that shutter down and they hear it shooting at 11 frames per second, like that, and they go, oh my God, really? And then they think it can't possibly be in focus. None of them will be in focus. And then you play them back afterwards, you know, because you all chimp afterwards, you know, you look at your pictures on the screen and you're like, oh yeah, I got one of those as well. Yeah, that's pretty good. Let's have a look at that. And you're zooming in, let's have a look at the eyes or, you know, the sponsor's logos, and they're all sharp. And you see it dawn on them. As has happened with all of us with new technology, whether it's a 4K telly or a projector or I remember the first time I saw like a smartphone, you know, the first iPhone or something, I was like, what, a touchscreen? Are you mad? And then you see it, and at some point you're like, oh yeah, I get it. And
yeah, now right.
And it happens to everyone, sometimes sooner, sometimes later. And you can see it. I love it. I love showing these pros this little Sony A6000 and its successes, because they laugh at you. And about half an hour later, they're crying. Literally, half an hour after that, they're like, I'm buying one of them. And I'll say, well, you could buy 10 of them and still spend less money than that.
Right.
And we've got the same picture. Now, I've no doubt that if we both dropped them on the concrete floor, that there's stood a better chance of surviving. But like I say, I could buy 10 of them. So I could have another 3 in my boot, car, my trunk, sorry. And you know what I mean? I could buy spares. I just have spares as replacements. And they say, oh, yeah, battery life's rubbish. Yeah, the battery's life's rubbish because it's a tiny little battery. You just buy more batteries. There's no big deal, right? You just buy, you know, if it runs out of power, just pick up the other one because it was so cheap, you've got another one. So, yeah, Sony's autofocus is brilliant. Their burst shooting is brilliant. They were the second major company to really go into mirrorless after Micro Four Thirds. You know, it was more than a year afterwards, so it's taken them a while to build up their lens catalog. But the mirrorless E-mount now has, I think, 36 lenses. And the A-mount before it, which was like the Konica Minolta, the DSLR, and later the SLT system, which was a clever translucent mirror technology, has got 33 lenses. And you can adapt those easily onto the E-mount. So 36 native E-mount, another 33 adaptable A-mount. You can very successfully adapt Canon lenses. So it's a really nice system. If you're a Canon shooter and you want to move over to mirrorless, it can provide a good route for you, partly also because it's the only one that provides a full frame option for mirrorless. That's not Leica. Yeah, I'm not talking about the, you know, the really high-end stuff. Sony pioneered full frame mirrorless with the A7 series and then split it into three lines. You've got kind of like the A7 is like their middle of the road, solid one. And then you've got their low light, the A7S, and then you've got their high resolution, the A7R. Both, all of those are Mark II versions. And at the rate that they're developing, no doubt there'll be Mark III ones soon. And they're just, I mean, like the A7R Mark II, what an unbelievable camera. 42 megapixel, full frame. So ridiculously high resolution, but also low noise, high quality 4K video, whether you're shooting full frame or a crop. It does everything, that camera. The only thing that camera doesn't have is a touch screen, and I wish it had. And I also wish it was a fully articulated screen, something that Olympus and Panasonic deploy commonly. And that, I think, is where some of the other companies have let themselves down a bit. Sony needs more touch screens, I think, but they've got it on the A6500. Fingers crossed they have it on the Mark III A7s. I really hope they do. Because I love tapping the screen to pull focus.
You know? I remember that even from when we were shooting 3-4 years ago, you were using the touch screen the whole time.
You know, if you want to reposition the AF area quickly, yeah, you could go click, 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 or you could just touch it. Why, right. You know, sometimes it's nice to click, 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 but I want the option, you know, and if you don't like the touch screen, we'll switch it off. You know, don't ruin my day.
What's your take on like the full frame Sonys versus a Canon or Nikon for like a landscape shooter? I'm a serious landscape shooter. I'm not going to shoot JPEGs. I'm going to bring them back on my computer. I'm going to spend a lot of time on them. That's a big choice that people make.
Yeah, well, for me, if I'm shooting landscapes, I'm going to be hiking somewhere. So I want something that's not going to weigh a ton, but give me good quality. So I'm always going to go for a mirrorless body over a DSLR, especially as, you know, when I first tested the D800s, the first time like 36 megapixels came along, it really struck home to me comparing it to the 20 megapixel Canon at the time, I think 5D Mark II at the time, was that this was a camera that was the closest I ever had to a medium format in terms of being demanding on your technique. You could not be sloppy on your focusing. You should be using a tripod, especially if you're not using stabilized lenses. You should be using not only a self-timer or a cable release, but mirror lockup. You have to be meticulous with your technique, absolutely precise. Otherwise, I was finding like I could only get 36 megapixels worth of detail out of the Nikon if I was shooting with it that carefully. If I was hand-holding and mucking about with it, I was getting more like 20. It wasn't any better than the Canon at 20. And I'm not entirely sure where I'm going with this now. But what I found was that what Sony did with the mirrorless, first of all, you don't have a mirror in it, obviously, because it's mirrorless. You don't have this physical thing slapping around that needs to be damped. There is no mirror locker because there's no mirror, right? Right. They're using an electronic front curtain now, which means there is no physical motion when you start that exposure, only when you end it. And this all means that, oh, and the other thing, that's what I was going to say. In terms of focusing, you need to do it in live view. You cannot trust the phase detect AF system. It could be slightly calibrated incorrectly with your lens. You can't trust it for precision stuff like that. Fine for tracking sports and the rest of it, but not for a proper landscape. If you're shooting high resolution, you need to shoot live view, you need to magnify that image, you need to look super carefully at 100%. So you're going to be shooting in live view, which is what mirrorless cameras do. You're going to be worrying with the DSLR about the mirror slap, which you don't have in a mirrorless camera. You're going to be worrying about that first curtain, which you don't have on the mirrorless camera if you're using an electronic. And all these things, it began to just sort of say, why aren't you using a mirrorless camera? It is designed for this. It does not vibrate in the same way. And when Sony came out with this ridiculously high resolution sensor, that was good even in low light. You know, and that you could adapt your Canon lenses to if you wanted. But then I remember when the Mark Ones came out, they were all like, look how good you can adapt these with, say, the Metabones adapter. But now they don't mention that so much anymore because Sony's got so many of its own lenses and they're really good. They're not cheap, especially the good ones. They're not cheap, but they're...
And neither are the cameras.
Yeah, they're really, really good. And they're going after that high end, especially with the G Master lenses. So for me, I think for high-end landscape stuff now and portraiture, studio work, I would sooner have a Sony A7R Mark II than I would a top-end Canon or Nikon. I mean, for me, those top-end Canon, Nikon DSLRs have become real specialists, very narrow, very vertical targets of like top-end professional sports and wildlife photographers who need 500mm F4 lenses. Everyone else is beginning to be better served elsewhere in different ways. And, you know, Sony's pushing autofocus so hard now. Yeah, in some ways, a Canon or Nikon DSLR will be better at autofocusing, but in other ways, the Sony will be better, especially with its coverage, this virtually the whole sensor. You know, you look at Canon and Nikon, they're only autofocusing well in the little diamond pattern. As soon as you put them in live view, they become much slower. Well, the Sony's keeping up, but it's on a much broader area. So you don't have to think, oh, I've got to make sure, I've got to position my subject there, otherwise it won't be able to autofocus on it. That's not an issue. So yeah, I think the Sony A7R Mark II is a remarkable, remarkable body, even though it's a few years old now. And in Sony's terms, that's, you know, that's the beginning of time. Mm-hmm. So they've done really well. And models like the A6500 and the A6300, that's what I want to take for sports. If you're a parent with active kids or pets or something like that, that is a hard camera to beat. And if you're an active parent with active kids and pets and you're on a budget, the A6000, that's your camera. It will keep them sharp in sharp focus, you know, at sports days, or even if they're, you know, they're going on to like a more professional level. Like I say, I've shot professional sports with it. No problem. No problem at all. So, you know, unless you want a 500mm F4, an 800mm F5.6, right. You know what I mean?
I do.
Sony's done a really good job. And they're great at video as well, because, of course, Sony's got massive experience in broadcast and professional video. So their video quality is also very, very good. But again, as an electronics company, I feel they're lacking, again, in the heritage of the controls. And even though they bought Konica Minolta, the cameras they're bringing out are very much Sony cameras. And you can imagine a conversation taking place with the design team where they go, look, you know, we need bigger dials or bigger buttons. The photographers want them. And then someone else overrules it and says, yes, but we're Sony and we do little things, or this is our style, this is our house style. If we did that, it would look too much like an Olympus or a Canon. We don't want to do that. We want to be identifiable, and that's fine, but I feel it compromises their usability. I think their controls let them down. So I sometimes feel like I'm fighting against the controls. So I think they've got some work to do. They need to improve their controls. They need to put touch screens on them, but otherwise they're pretty much there. You know, the technology is phenomenal and they're developing at a terrifying pace. Can you imagine being one of their rivals, you know, thinking how many cameras have they brought out this year? And it's not like they're all the same. You know, they're
on the other hand, I don't necessarily want to buy an A7 Mark II because I think the next one's going to come out next month or whatever. And then maybe another one a year after that.
But it doesn't make the old one redundant. I mean, it's frustrating. It might be frustrating that there's, you know, a better one. In particular, the A6500 followed the A6300 very, very quickly. That would be frustrating if you bought the 6300, but it's a more expensive camera, and the 6300 doesn't suddenly become a bad camera, you know. So I would be very happy with an A7R Mark II. And I have been. I've tested it a lot. There's A7R Mark II pictures in this book, and also a picture of the Tour de France taken with the 6,000, I think, 6,000 or 6,300.
Yeah, I saw that one.
Just nailed it so easily and so light. And that was on top of a mountain. I had to walk quite a lot to get to that location.
But you didn't
have to carry it. They all ride their bikes, you know. A lot of the spectators ride their bikes there.
Huh.
I park my car as close as I can, then walk and then hike. Mm-hmm. I take an AeroPress and a hand grinder for my coffee and a little pan and some sausages and a camp stove. And the French love that. They walk past, they're like, oh, monsieur, très bien. I'm frying up a sausage, a sausage on sandwich, and I'm brewing up my coffee with a hand ground coffee. They're like, you know, well, they like
well
that.
Done.
They like that. And I'm like, yeah.
Well done, sir.
Yeah.
Very good. So last one then, Fuji.
Yeah, Fuji. Now, some of you might be going, what about Pentax? I can't talk about Pentax because I'm legally, because there's a man outside the door with a gun pointed at me with a Sony t-shirt. No, none of that's happening. some of you know, I'm obviously British. You probably recognize the accent. I live in Great Britain at the moment. Less great than it was recently. But anyway, we said we weren't going to talk about that. But anyway, I moved to New Zealand for 6 years and continued writing camera labs and publishing stuff just with nicer scenery for a while, and then moved back. But when I moved there, it really confused some companies, and Pentax was one of them. They couldn't get their head around it, and they just couldn't supply me with stuff. It was not a problem for anyone else. But they were like, but people in America and Britain read it, but you're in New Zealand. Yeah, it's on the internet, but you're not there. You're there and we're here. I was like, oh, forget about it. And it was unfortunate because I have owned a lot of Pentax kit and I really like it, and they're doing some really innovative stuff. But unfortunately, I don't get to review them. So I can't talk about them. So that leaves one major brand left, and that is Fujifilm. You're holding up. What was that?
X-T2.
X-T2. I was going to say I'll raise you, but I won't. You've raised me. I will go down a level, and this is the X-T20.
Ah, nice. A new one.
I'm reviewing at the moment, which is like a kind of... Well, it's the X-T2 sensor in the X-T10 body. So it's a smaller, lighter version, giving you the same image quality.
I've used the X-T10. I liked it a lot.
Mm. Yeah, it's really nice. That's another great mid-range camera. You should definitely look into that if you're into mid-range. Now, I'm going to come out. I've just got to go back to Sony for a second. They are also doing really good work with built-in stabilization. And I mentioned that because Fujifilm is not.
Right.
I'll come on to that more in a minute. I just wanted to mention that. Fujifilm, as you can see, if you hold up yours and I hold up mine, they're great in the retro styling. They've also adopted an older fashioned approach to exposure control. You have a shutter speed dial, you have an aperture ring. There is no PASM on these cameras, although you can configure them to effectively act as if they're in PASM. And they've got front and rear dials that can, you know, adjust them in that way. But really, it's about these physical controls. You may like it, you may not like it, but I tell you what, even though I am actually... probably prefer the PASM approach to control, I can't help but fancying these cameras. You know, they're attractive cameras. I look at them and I'm like, well, hey, you know, how are you doing? You know, these are good looking cameras, especially the X-T2, I think is one of the best looking cameras around. And when I was testing that, when it was like on my shelf and I was getting ready to go out and shoot, it'd be going, hey, you ready to shoot with me? And I'm like, yeah. I'm looking forward to going out with you, dude. You know, they're good looking cameras. So they've really adopted that kind of retro chic. But let's look at Fujifilm's heritage, because of course they have a great deal of it. They are huge in film, processing, printing, all of that. And they still do a lot of printing and processing. And even though film is kind of declining, gone back up again, I think they still make film for some markets, maybe cinema. I'm not sure. But anyway, they have certainly a massive amount of experience in film. And they brought that over to digital in their X series, which is their mirrorless format. So this came after Sony. It came after Micro Four Thirds. It's called the X mount. This is Fuji system. It's the youngest of that group. And as such, it has the least number of lenses. I think there's only about 20 of them at the last time I counted. So there's not much choice at each focal length. You go to Micro Four Thirds, you say, look, I want an 85 mil equivalent. You've got a choice of three or four lenses. With Fuji, there may only be one, but what they have done is made them all brilliant. So you don't want any other choice. You just buy that one. You
right.
Know, and it makes it easy. And you don't feel bad about it because it's great quality. You know, you want an 85 mil equivalent, you get the 56 1.2 and it's great. You want a 135 equivalent, you get the 90 mil and it's great. That's such a sharp lens, really nice lens. You want an ultra wide zoom for your landscapes and urban stuff like I do, you get the 10-24 and you're super happy with it. Or you get the 16 mil 1.4 for a 24 mil equivalent. They're all good. It's boring reviewing their lenses because you go, here's another great lens. 35 mil f2, which everyone should have. That becomes like a 50 mil equivalent great lens. So it's a small system of lenses, but they're all really, really good. They do vary quite a lot in terms of autofocusing speed. Now, when the X system came out, they were very good at color. They were very good at their image quality. They were horrific at autofocus. They were so slow. They just didn't work very well. Fujifilm has put a massive amount of work in that. And fast forward to their third generation sensor, the X-Trans 3, which is in the X-Pro 2, the X-T2, the X100F, and the X-T20, which I just showed you. It's got a broader array of phase detect AF points. And if you couple that with one of their fast lenses, in particular the 50-140, I have a bit of dyslexia with that lens. I always call it a 40-150, but it's a 50-140. You have it, 2.8.
It's big.
Can you tell me, it is a 50-140, isn't it?
It is.
Good. I got it right. I always say the other way around. It's because there's a 40 to 150 Olympus. It gets me. Mm-hmm. That lens focuses really quickly with that body that Chris has got, the X-T2 and any of those other ones that share that same sensor. And you can shoot sports with it. I have shot sports with it. Mm-hmm. It's a narrower area than the Sony has, but it's a big fat square. It's almost as tall as the sensor and it is square shape. You keep your subject within there and it will focus pretty quickly on it. And it will shoot quickly as well, 8 frames per second with autofocus, or yours will also do 14 frames per second with the electronic shutter, or 11 frames per second if you have the grip, which is really nice. So they have kind of resolved those, and the video is much better than it was as well. But the thing that they're really good at for me is their processing, right? So they've taken all of their film heritage, all of their skills in color, and packaged up their processing very cleverly, clever branding, by giving it the names of their classic film stock. So you have Provia, Velvia, Astia, and then they've got some of that they've made up, but that sound good, like Classic Chrome and Across, stuff like that. And it is just branding, but they do put a lot of work into the actual color in the process as well. The bottom line is that on a lot of cameras, you go through their different effects or their profiles, and you're like, I'm just going to stay on standard. It's okay. Olympus ones are quite good, but some of them are not so good on other formats. But the Fuji ones, I'm proud to use, and partly because they've got cool names, but mostly because they produce great results. And I said in my book that there's 100 pictures. There must be at least 40 of them with Fujifilm cameras, and just the colors are really nice. And when I want to shoot black and white, like that Acros, which you get on the latest generation, is beautiful black and white out of camera. You don't need to do anything to it. I think out of all of the cameras that we've talked about, the out-of-camera JPEG quality is best of all on Fujifilm, second best on Olympus. So if you want the best-looking pictures without any effort, with no effort, go for Fujifilm, right? If you want a great-looking retro camera, go for Fujifilm. The one Achilles heel for them, which didn't used to be an issue but is now becoming a thing, is that they don't have built-in stabilization. It's become a thing because it's not just Olympus that has it now. Panasonic has it and has become really good at it. Sony has it and has become pretty good at it, which means that Fujifilm is the only major mirrorless company to not have it. And as I understand it, technically, they might not be able to do it either, because the way they designed the... When you design a lens system, you design it to produce a sharp image of a certain size, and that size has to cover your target sensor, right? They call it the imaging circle because lenses are circular, and that's the most efficient way to make them. So anything inside this circle is going to be sharp, right? So you design your circle to be exactly the same size as your sensor. No point making it any bigger unless you're going to be using a bigger sensor in the future. So you have to think about that. If your system was APS-C and you get a full frame, you need optics with a better imaging circle. What happens though, if you're shifting the sensor to provide body-based stabilization, well, that sensor is moving around and it effectively is covering a bigger area. It's like you've got a bigger sensor. It breaks that imaging circle. And that means one of two things. It either means that to maintain top quality, you need a bigger imaging circle, or you accept that the quality is not going to look as good in the corners and the edges. And Fujifilm is very particular about its image quality. It does not want to compromise the quality at the edges and the corners. And I believe it's sufficiently tight to the imaging circle that they can't do it. Maybe they can. Maybe they'll find a way. I hope they can, because unfortunately, some of my favorite Fujifilm lenses are not stabilized optically, like the 56-1.2, the 90mm, not optically stabilized. And I find that 90mm very hard to handhold because it doesn't have stabilization. Yeah, of course, I can dial in a fast shutter speed to avoid camera shake. That's no problem. It's got great high ISO performance. That's no problem. The problem is when you're composing and that view, either through the viewfinder or screen, is doing this.
Right.
It's wobbling around. And again, I'm trying to shoot very precisely. I want to get the target exactly in the middle. I want it to be exactly straight. And it's doing that. It's so much easier to get it right on a stabilized system. And that I don't get with all of the lenses on Fujifilm. Now, of course, some of them are optically stabilized. That zoom you showed me is. The 10-24 I mentioned is optically stabilized, but the 35 isn't. The 56 isn't. The 90 isn't. Most of the primes are not. And that's that to me is a now become... a thing, a downside.
But the type of photography you're doing is not the type of photography that a lot of people do. A lot of people that are going to shoot at Blue Hour, they really do want to shoot with a tripod. They want to take the time to set it up and you know, and to compose rather than trying to get 20 shots at Blue Hour. And then they could also argue that if I'm going to use the 56-1.2, that I want it to be a fast shutter. I'm going to shoot it at 1.2, 1.4, whatever, and I don't need it. So for the type of shooting that you do, it totally makes sense, but maybe not for everybody. I don't know.
I completely agree. And this is critically important to think about how you photograph. Because again, I could say, yeah, I could have put you off Fujifilm there. But as Chris quite rightly points out, if you don't need the stabilization because either you don't wobble as much as me or you shoot from a tripod or you just don't care, then you don't need it. But when you have been shooting a lot with Olympus, because that's one of the other systems I shoot a lot with an Olympus EM1, and the EM5 before it, I got so used to having that. Right. You miss it when it's not there. But if you didn't have it, it's a bit like the touchscreen. I really miss not having a touchscreen on the Fujifilm bodies. They've done it on the X-T20. This has a touchscreen now, but they've been quite... It is, but it's quite. They've been quite conservative on what it does. You can tap to reposition the AF area, which is what you want, and to pull focus in movies. You can swipe and playback and pinch and all the rest of it, but you can't operate the user interface with it. And it's got this big Q menu interface where it presents big chunky icons that are just, to me, crying out to be tapped. It looks like a touch interface, but it's not. So I think they need to... But, you know, given to at least the hardware, the hardware's there now. So they could, you know, they could implement that with a firmware update. And Fuji's really good at doing firmware updates. So is Olympus. They're great at going back to a camera that's 3 years old and go, you know, now you're going to have better autofocus or better, you're going to have some interval timer facility or something. And we're just going to pile it in. Fujifilm, bizarrely, now this doesn't bother me, but might bother you or bother some people, only 3-frame AEB.
Yeah, I think they just fixed that. No,
is that on the firmware update?
I believe it is. I could be saying that wrong. I think it is. Yeah, there are like 30 new things, so I think so. Yeah. And the other one that I'm looking forward to with this is I haven't done it yet. Is with almost all these cameras, it limits you to 30 seconds. It's 30 second long exposure unless you have your cable release, and I think it's going to go up to 30 minutes now. So
that you can dial straight in.
Yeah, uh-huh.
That would be awesome. I would use that a lot. Now, that's one of the nice things with strange things, actually, about Micro Four Thirds is that both Panasonic and Olympus bodies let you dial straight to 60 seconds. It's just the next thing along from 30 seconds. They both do 60 seconds, whereas most other cameras stop at 30. 60, there's a big difference between 30 and 60 seconds when you're doing a long exposure. It could be enough. And what Olympus also do is they have great bulb timers, which... will switch the exposure off after, say, 2 minutes, 4 minutes, 15 minutes, half an hour, whatever. And that's really nice. And that's something that I have missed and complained about Fujifilm. So if they've resolved that in an update, then that's fantastic because that makes it much more usable for long exposure photography. And I should say, I went along on a photo walk. Photo walk's great. We've talked about photo walks before. Find one, hang out with other photographers, even if it's an Instameet, you know, or it doesn't have to be high end. It can be high end, low end. Every level, they're great. You'll meet lots of people, learn lots of new things. I went along to one which specialized in long exposure photography because I was really wanting to find out more about it a few years ago. I talked about that in the book. And most of them were shooting with Fujifilm cameras. And I thought, well, that's interesting. I wonder why they're doing that. And it turned out that they produce very, very clean results, even with long exposure noise reduction turned off, which is critical because... You know, it captures the same exposure again. If you're shooting 1 second, it's going to take a 1 second exposure afterwards as a dark frame. That's no big deal. You're shooting a 4 minute exposure, it's going to shoot another 4 minute exposure. Then that's no good, especially with failing light in the Blue Hour or when there's fireworks going off and you need to capture that, or everyone's gone to the pub and has left you on a cold and dark coastline. You're like, why am I waiting for this dark frame to be recorded? And Fuji's really good at that. So I should say that. And then that was one of the reasons I took it up as well as one of my other formats. And it just produces, you know, the bottom line, it produces really nice pictures very, very easily. And I'm interested to see you're shooting it because you were Canon DSLRs for a long time. So why did you buy the X-T2?
Oh, well, I just feel that it's the best combination. And I had the X-T1 as well. I feel like it's the best combination of being light and still having a great sensor. I feel that the Sony full frames, like I'm going to have to get lenses that are the exact same size as all my Canon ones anyway. So I didn't save that much. And yet I think the image quality for the long exposures and stuff is better than the Micro Four Thirds. But
yes, it's definitely cleaner. It's definitely cleaner. The MFT stuff can be good, but it can struggle beyond a certain amount. I should also say Fujifilm has now also redeveloped its heritage in medium format. Fujifilm made a ton of medium format film cameras back in the day. I even had one, a panoramic one. But they've now done medium format digital with the GFX series. So they're kind of going into that. They've decided to skip full frame, and people who want a bigger sensor than X series, they're going to go to medium format digital. And I've shot with that camera. I've got some sample images at cameralabs.com. So check that out. Really, really nice looking image quality. And it shoots exactly like an X body. The controls are exactly the same. The buttons are in the same places. I mean, it's obviously it's bigger, but it's still about the same size as a 5D Mark, you know, 3 or 4. So it's the size of a full frame DSLR, but it's actually a medium format mirrorless digital. So it's awesome. It's an interesting format.
All right. So here's the big question. You get one camera. What's it going to be, Gordon?
Right now, I really like the X-T2. I struggle with its lack of stabilization, but I like the X-T2 for my style of photography. Just the fact that Fujifilm's produced, because I'm shooting JPEG most of the time, or I am shooting RAW for insurance. I'm not totally mad, but I want to get the result from the JPEG if possible. And Fujifilm gives me my best shot at that. So within their range, I don't get on with the X-Pro series. I love it technologically. I get why street photographers like it. But for me, I want the big electronic viewfinder, like the style of the X-T2. They just really nailed it. If it had a touch screen, it would be amazing. And if it had built-in stabilization, then that would probably be me. It's a really nice system. But the others, you know, when I'm shooting sports, I use the Sony. You know, if I want a ridiculous file, I do that. If I'm shooting the space shuttle or a bird at 50 miles away, I get the Canon. You know, you can rent them. You can rent different cameras. And I do that. You know, when I shot a space shuttle launch, one of the last space shuttle launches, I rented a massive Canon lens because I needed a massive lens. So rent, you know, get the camera that's best for, buy the camera that's best for most of your photography, but don't necessarily assume it's going to, you know, solve all of your issues, because you may find one thing, you know, like if you're shooting an event, then maybe you want the one with the best flash system. So just, you know, if you're going to a mate's wedding, you might want to rent something just for that.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? It doesn't have to be, don't assume that one thing will do it all.
I take back my answer from earlier. When I had Canon Professional Services, they sent me a 500 F4. They sent me a 600 to borrow, you know, I didn't have to rent it. And so all you have to pay is like the shipping back or whatever. You get a certain amount. If they have it in, they'll send it to you and you can borrow it. I don't know if they'll send it if UK how it is, but so those are the best things. I remember walking around, what was the deal? I didn't have the tripod collar I didn't have something. And I remember having to handhold the 500 F4 walking around the Botanic Garden, and people were giving me looks, but what are you going to do?
I've done that. I took the 500 F4 to Florida for the shuttle launches because it was the biggest lens that I could get in a think tank airport accelerator, which is the biggest bag you can take on as hand luggage. So that was the requirement. And that lens is amazing. And it's got really good built-in stabilization. I handheld that a few times, but Kroms, you know, you're like that, you know, that picture of that guy with the cigarette.
Yeah, exactly.
Like this. And it's not discreet. It's not a discreet lens. You know, people notice you. And, you know, I was on the beach with it a lot because that's where, you know, Cape Kennedy is. And Kennedy Space Center, rather. And, you know, but I was shooting a lot of wildlife in the wetlands, which was fantastic for that. Logs, which may or may not have been alligators or, you know.
We don't know.
It can be quite scary, but it was a fun lens to shoot and for great sure. quality. But I would not want to own one because it's like $6,000 or $10,000 or something ridiculous, but you can rent it. I rented it for a weekend from Borrow Lenses for like $100 or something.
There you go.
And then they take it away from you, which is great. Then it goes and you continue your vacation or your travels without carrying this ridiculously big, heavy, and very expensive, vulnerable piece of kit. You just get rid of it. You say, right, I've got my shot of the bear at Brooks Falls or of the space shuttle or of the whatever, the sporting event, give it away, and then go back to your nice compact whatever system you use for your general stuff.
Right. So what have we got to look forward to from Camera Labs here? You're doing the X-T20 right now. Is that going to be your next one?
That is my next review, will be the XT20. The big news at Camera Labs is that I finally redesigned it after only 12 years of publishing a web version 0.8. I was doing static HTML with a site that was left justified, centered on the page, definitely very mobile unfriendly. And, you know, there comes a time, which was about 5 years ago, that Google and other companies punish you if you're a publisher and you're not adopting new formats, as indeed they should. You know, I was giving a terrible experience on mobile and tablet. So it was long overdue, and it's taken me years, literally years, to do it and convert some of the content. But Camera Labs is now version 2.0. Mm-hmm. It is fully mobile friendly, but thank you very much. Half the people that access it are on phones. The other half of the people are massive screens, you know, like 4K monitors. So I wanted to make sure it looked good on big screens as well. So all of the imagery, which I take myself of the product shots, it's all retina aware. So if you've got a retina or high DPI display, it should look really crisp, really sharp. The photography should look really nice. I've not been afraid to use big images with a big column width. There's hardly any adverts on it at all, because I hate all the clickbait that you see on so many editorial sites now. I've really kept it to the minimum. But as such, that means that I really rely on people to support me. You know, if you're ever buying anything at Adorama, B&H or Amazon, you can really help me if you click through the links to order stuff. They share some commission. That's how it works. Buy me a coffee, the t-shirt, the book. That's how you support your independent editorial site. So if you like what I do and what people like me do, people like Chris do, you've got to support us because it's really hard otherwise, because we don't get any advertising money. But there's Camera Labs. As you know, I do a podcast with Doug Kay. We do a gear one. In fact, only earlier today, I recorded the XT20 podcast with him.
So nice.
Look out for that. We're listed on iTunes and now on Google Play. So have a listen or have a look. Still on YouTube.
What's the name again?
It's called the Camera Labs Photography Podcast.
Well, there you go. There you go.
It's all in there. And if you're interested in any of my own photography, just look for Camera Labs on Instagram or Twitter. That's the best place to find my stuff.
And the one thing I forgot is in the book, front of the book, Trey Ratcliffe, he calls you the camera whisperer. I love it.
That was before he knew that it was like the anti-HDR book.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, don't tell him.
Trey likes to post-process. Trey's a fantastic photographer. I really, really love his work. He's a good friend of mine. And even though he's really into post-processing, he's also interested in how other people work and all the rest of it. So he was very generous, very kind with his quote. So if you're listening, Trey, thank you very much. Yes. And he's also doing a big tour around Europe. You know, I think he's starting in Lisbon. He's going through London, I think maybe Barcelona or Madrid and Paris and a ton of other places. So if you're a big Trey fan, go and catch up with him on his tour.
Yep. And get on one of those. Is he doing photo walks? That's what he did last year.
Yeah. Photo walks at every, similar to what he did in the US, I think last year was it. He did, he's doing that in Europe at about 10 cities or something like that. It's quite a lot. It's a big, it looks like an exciting thing. So I hope to catch up with him at some point on that journey.
You should. And we hope to catch up with you when you do your tour here to the States this summer. You said you'll be around, right?
Yeah. I'm going to be around. So it'd be lovely to catch up with you. Maybe we should do some photo walks and get some other people together. Find out those other angles. Get those pictures for the second book.
That's right. Version two. Yeah. Volume two. All right. Well, very good. Thank you so much. This went really long, but it's great. This is like the definitive Gordon Lang Camera Labs interview. This is like everything you'd ever need to know. So thank you so much for doing it. Really appreciate you taking the time.
I absolutely loved it, Chris. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you anyone who's stuck it out to the end. Well done.
Yeah, exactly.
Well done. I mean, I make you wait on the Camera Labs podcast, but this went even further, I think. So,
well, we appreciate it.
We love you and appreciate it. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Gordon.
See you later.
Hey, if you made it through the whole thing, I'm really impressed. Gordon, he's not one to make things short and sweet. He's going to go into all those details. And really, that's just like his site at cameralabs.com. If you want to read about that A9, the Sony A9, or any of these other cameras, he goes in depth on them and hits all the features. And so, yeah, he's not short on words. So if you made it to the very end, congratulations. Don't forget to join us at the Out of Chicago Conference, June 23rd through the 25th. Single-day tickets are available. And also, if you are signing up for the full conference, there's a code for podcast listeners, and it's OOCPodcast. You'll save $100 off the conference. I hope you join us there. OOCPodcast, like Out of Chicago Podcast. Yeah, right? Perfect. All right, so thank you to Gordon Lang. Thank you for listening, and I hope we see you at the end of June.
We'll be right back.